This is the true story of one of the most exciting episodes in the history of science and technology. A secret project to send a spaceship the size of an ocean liner to Mars and beyond, propelled by thousands of nuclear bombs. Awesome, fantastic, crazy even, Project Orion attracted some of the best minds in science for reasons that reveal much about scientists, their dreams, and their nightmares. The Orion story begins with the detonation of the world's first atomic bomb in the New Mexico desert in July 1945. In the most expensive experiment of all time, scientists have shaped 5,000 pounds of high explosive to squeeze a sphere of plutonium the size of a baseball into an uncontrollable chain reaction of atoms splitting atoms. If it works, the next bomb will be used on Hiroshima. That morning, many strange thoughts went through the minds of the scientists who built the bomb.
I am the Come Death, the destroyer of worlds. I remembered that Sanskrit line.
While Oppenheimer thought of death and destruction, Stanislaw Ulam, the Polish mathematician, wondered if the immense power of a nuclear explosion could take the first men to the planet.
His idea was to have these little explosions propel a rocket into space. Little explosions of atomic bombs. But he certainly liked to dream about that going to the stars.
13 years later, Ulam's idea became a top-secret multi-million-dollar US government project. At the heart of it was a British mathematics and physics genius, Freeman Dyson.
Well, I'd thought of space travel as something that would happen and that I would like to be a part of it. But that had always been a sort of vague and theoretical idea. And now suddenly, here it became real. Here was a real project which offered just the kind of things I'd been dreaming about. As a child, going into space was something I'd love to do in my lifetime.
When he was 5, Dyson calculated the number of atoms in the sun. By the age of 25, he'd cracked some of the most intractable problems in theoretical physics and been given a job for life at Princeton alongside Oppenheimer and Einstein. But he found Project Orion irresistible.
So the first trip would have been a landing on Mars. The ship would have landed using its bombs. And then about 50 people would pile out and do their stuff. We had thought of it as an analogy of the voyage of the Beagle when Darwin made all his great discoveries.
Dyson's son George, a science historian, was 5 years old when he first heard about Project Orion.
It was this great romantic part of my father's youth. He never did anything like that again. And at the time, of course, it was tremendously exciting to have a father who was going to build a spaceship.
He expected to go along. I remember he asked me once if there would be a little seat beside mine where he could sit and things of that kind. So it was always for him a memory of some quite fabulous sort of fairy story that happened when he was little.
George returned to the Orion story 40 years later and wrote a book about it, partly to establish the facts, but also as a way to understand his father better. As a teenager, George ran away from home to live in a treehouse on the west coast of Canada.
I mean, the simplest explanation is that, you know, son of Freeman Dyson builds 95-foot-high treehouse to escape the shadow of his father, that, you know, it was... My father never built treehouses, so I could have the world's highest treehouse, even though I was not going to do anything in physics.
George earned a living designing and building boats, but his real interest was writing about the history of science. He wrote a seminal account of the evolution of computers before tackling Orion.
Writing a book is the way, you know, that's the doorway that sort of leads to the knowledge. That was a way I could devote 3 years of my life to finding out the story that had always sort of escaped me.
George's research took him across the United States, anxious to trace other surviving members of the Orion team and gather their accounts before it was too late.
I'm at a very strong disadvantage in that I don't know how much of the project has been declassified, so I may not be able to answer all your questions, but I was thrilled when I found out what it was.
To uncover the true story of Orion, George had to struggle to get key documents declassified. But much remains secret. Even now, his father can't tell George everything he knows.
We don't want to give the terrorists instructions for how to build cheap bombs. And that was, of course, one of our purposes. So the details of the bombs certainly will be kept secret and should be.
George discovered that even Stan Ulam's original memorandum on using atomic bombs to propel rockets is still classified, locked up in a safe at Los Alamos. And the idea might have been forgotten had it not been for what happened in Russia on the evening of October the 4th, 1957.
A country went through a very fearful reaction to Sputnik.
It gets the American people alarmed that a foreign country, especially an enemy country, can do this, and if we fear this.
Sputnik was essentially something the size of a basketball launched in space. And it went around and it beeped. And there it was, and it was obvious that the Russians could make bigger and better things, and they could come roaring over us in orbit.
Attention, all those who are in the streets. Run for the nearest shelter, but run as close to the walls of buildings as possible.
People were literally frightened, just as they were after 9/11 last year. You know, what is it? What kind of a weapon could it be? Is it a real threat? Does it mean that Russia is going to try to rule the world?
So suddenly the Russians had done it, and then, of course, it was obvious that we'd go ahead and do it too. So it was just an enormous window of opportunity that everybody in the government was willing to say yes to all sorts of weird schemes.
Of all the post-Sputnik schemes backed by the Eisenhower government, the most audacious by far was Project Orion, run out of General Atomics near San Diego. Its mastermind was Ted Taylor, America's leading atomic bomb designer. Taylor now lives in a nursing home in upstate New York.
Project Orion was an attempt to really get realistic about what's needed to get into space, to open the door to the scenes that are there all the time, waiting for us to see them up close and personal, to take a peek through one of the large windows and fly under the rings of Saturn. That was unbearably exciting. And that was what our life was about at that time. We really believed we were going to be doing it personally.
By the time the Russians put a dog into Earth orbit a month later, Taylor had sold the idea of a nuclear bomb-propelled spaceship with a crew of 50 men and women to his boss at General Atomics, the 34-year-old physicist and entrepreneur, Frederick de Hoffman.
There was only one Fred de Hoffman. It was said that he knew every millionaire in the world. That's probably not true, but I bet he knew every billionaire in the world. He was very good at raising money. A person who wanted results. You couldn't fool around if you worked for Fred D. Hoffman.
If Orion were to fly, General Atomics would need government backing. De Hoffman and Taylor believed Freeman Dyson could help them get it.
Undoubtedly, it was true that my name was worth quite a lot, because the main problem they had was just to achieve some sort of credibility. If you just talked about the project, said you were going to propel a ship with nuclear bombs, the immediate reaction was, well, this is crazy. The whole thing will blow up, and that'll be the end of it. And so they needed people with solid reputation just in order to have a chance to get the thing approved.
Of course, the project probably went through his mind in a few minutes. Can we withstand the temperatures? Can we withstand the shocks? Can we withstand the accelerations? Can we carry enough people? How big does the ship have to be? And so on. And he decided it was plausible. And in about 30 seconds of mental calculation, he said, yeah, it'll work. Let's go.
The Dysons moved to La Jolla in Southern California.
One morning in the end of May 1958, driving to school, I was told Daddy's building a spaceship. And when we did go to General Atomic, I thought they were building the spaceship right there. I thought that big round building was the beginning of the spaceship.
George was to find out later that he'd been right about scale. The circular library building at General Atomics was the same diameter as the base of a full-size Orion, which would tower 200 feet above it.
I can remember very well when Ted Taylor first explained the Orion idea. He said, the nuclear bomb is so strong that if you have a standard-sized spaceship of the type we were thinking of for chemical propellants, the acceleration that you would have with the force on a small mass would be so large that it would pulverize the spaceship. He said, let's make it big. Let's make it, instead of a few tons, let's make it a few thousand tons. And this means with the same force, you would have much less acceleration. Because it has to be so big, we should change the way we think of spacecraft. Instead of them being designed for the minimum possible weight with just the right strength, which means very fragile for the operation, let's make it in a standard engineering design, built like the Brooklyn Bridge or a building. Let's make it out of steel, just ordinary steel. And let's make everything aboard it, life support systems, like a hotel.
I kept saying we should have a conventional store-bought barber's chair up there, just to show how scornful we could be of anything that was up there just to save weight.
Taylor and Dyson headhunted some 50 scientists and engineers for the project, among them Jeremy Bernstein, a physicist at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, where consultants were paid to think the unthinkable.
And the RAND Corporation was like a malignant university. It was this faculty all devoted to the Cold War. In the physics division, for example, there was Herman Kahn, who is no longer with us, but he was then writing about megadeths and trying to habituate us to the idea that if we only killed a few millions here and there, it would come out all right in the end. It's a gigantic man who clearly had never missed a meal. This whole business of these megadeths and everybody focused on H-bomb tests and so on, I found rather depressing. At this very time, the gossip was that Dyson, Freeman, was in La Jolla. He had been bitten by a dog, and he'd gone to a bullfight, and he was working on a spaceship. And so I wrote Freeman a letter, and I said, if any of these three things are true, being bitten by a dog or go to a bullfight or work on a spaceship, you're having a better time than I am, I wrote. Well, much to my amazement, a few days later, he called me and said, you should come down here. At that time, a General Atomic was known as Generous Atomics. People had wonderful summers and even winters on the beach in La Jolla. So it was kind of exotic. Restaurants served abalone steak and that sort of thing.
turn to me with a kiss in your... De Hoffman's General Atomics was a multi-million dollar company set up after the war to exploit the peaceful power of the atom. De Hoffman had helped plan the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now he was wooing his fellow bomb makers away from the weapons labs to his research Shangri-La.
The sun, to us the difference between life and death. It burns, stifles, dehydrates. But who would deny its warmth, its light, its beneficial radiation? So can it be with the energy man has created. The road is open, a road which may show us the cure for cancer, a road which may enable us to produce heat and power and new metals with atomic furnaces, new fuels, new ways to nourish the soil and correct vitamin and mineral deficiencies in the very food we eat. This can be our gift to generations yet unborn.
We all thought that nuclear energy was a great boon to mankind at that time, and we all thought that nuclear energy would cure the problems of poverty all over the world, and there were big talk about what nuclear energy would do. And that, of course, was certainly very much driven by this feeling, well, we've used nuclear energy, first of all, for killing people, now let's use it for doing something good.
Dyson spent World War II helping to plan the bombing of Germany, and many of the Orion scientists worked on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. They brought this history with them to Project Orion.
I do feel a moral responsibility for the almost 200,000 deaths. I had a small part in it, but still, that's an important ingredient. And that's a responsibility, it's not a regret. There's a difference.
Project Orion was a way of doing things in a benign, peaceful way that relied on their previous military experience in some ways. So it was a translation of a sword into a plowshare. And I think that's a lot of the spirit that imbued these people.
Nobody really liked the sort of mass murder aspect of bombs, but nevertheless, they loved playing around with bombs. So this was a way of having your cake and eating it too, that you could play around with bombs and still not be killing people, but exploring the universe.
It's one thing to theorize. It's another thing to hear a countdown off a loudspeaker and put on some dark glasses, and then all of a sudden to see this pow turn into a pow and rattle and actually break martini glasses that were on the shelves of the beach house that was used by the scientists that were there at the end of the day to have their martinis.
The Orion spaceship would ride on a wave of atomic explosions, each generating, for an instant, temperatures many times hotter than the surface of the sun.
The original reaction always was, that's absurd. And Ted then told a little story about the tower in New Mexico where they exploded the very first bomb. That tower was, I think, 200 feet high, and on top of it there was the bomb. And you saw the pictures then afterwards of the fireball of the bomb completely enveloping the tower. Everybody had the idea that since the bomb exploded on the tower, the whole tower was vaporized, there was nothing left. Well, what Ted actually did was he went to the test site, he looked for the pieces of the tower, and he found they were all still there. That every piece of that tower actually is still lying there in the desert. They were thrown considerable distances, but they were not vaporized.
Tests with high explosive showed that a bomb could push a model Orion without destroying it. This rare film was taken at the Point Loma Naval Test Range by Orion team member Jerry Astle. George Dyson learned that Astle was still living in nearby Solana Beach. and that he'd kept Orion relics. Jerry Astle had been recruited by Ted Taylor for his knowledge of explosives. Astle was a Czech resistance fighter, specializing in sabotage.
Now, this is the first model of Project Orion ever built.
Astle's experiments simulated the impact of nuclear bombs by detonating half-pound balls of plastic explosive suspended below a steel base plate.
This model, or the overgrown fat bullet, was actually what we anticipated first our prototype will look like. And we were trying to learn from it what are the pressures alongside the envelope, which will tell us to what kind of loads we have to design that envelope. We were testing shock absorber. What kind of damage will it suffer? And we made many shots, we made many tests, and to everybody's surprise, it didn't look bad at all. It looked like, indeed, you can design structure very easily, which will take all the loads.
That the ship is then going to be hit by the debris from this bomb, which is plasma traveling at approximately 300,000 miles an hour. The ship's going to be hit by that. You do that by having a pusher plate which absorbs the impact from that blast. Then this 1,000 ton steel plate is instantly accelerated to about 1,000 G's, 1,000 times the acceleration of gravity. Now your challenge becomes, how do you put some kind of shock absorbers between the ship and this plate?
It turns out, to everyone's surprise, that when you subject a large plate behind which there is a shock-absorbing system to a bomb explosion, that the plate absorbs the bomb materials and is accelerated. The shock absorber moderates that acceleration, and the final product of this is an acceleration which, very surprisingly to many people, a human being can tolerate.
The momentum that's given to the ship comes in jerks. And so the problem then is, how big a jerk can you actually give to a ship without destroying it? And that's really the limiting factor for this whole business. You have to calculate what sort of a jerk you can take. So something like 10 meters a second or 30 miles an hour is about the limit. If each bomb can only move you 10 meters a second in terms of velocity change, to get into orbit you need about 10 kilometers per second, so it means you need about 1,000 bombs.
The key calculation in the Orion project was what would happen to the steel pusher plate when exposed to intense heat and radiation from thousands of nuclear explosions.
As the plasma, which is moving, you know, at this 300,000 miles an hour and it's at a temperature of about 100,000 or 10,000 degrees, when it hits the plate and stagnates, slows down, it heats up, suddenly heats up to this burst of temperatures of the order of 100,000 degrees. What does that do to the steel surface?
So the plate will certainly lose a certain amount of material each time, and everything depends on how much. So there's where you have to have mathematics, you have to calculate. And so if it would remove a thousandth of an inch each time, then we'd know we'd be in very good shape. In 2,000 bombs, you'd lose only 2 inches. But if it lost a hundredth of an inch each time, then you'd lose 20 inches, and that meant you're probably in very bad shape. The bomb debris is a very high-temperature fluid, which is banging up against the bottom of the ship. So you have to do the hydrodynamics of this flow. You have to do the radiation flow into the solid material. You have to do the evaporation of the material. It was just a whole lot of problems, of the kind that I'm good at, the sort of practical problems involving mathematics.
In watching Freeman work, I was always impressed that he never seemed to cross anything out. He would just sit there and write these things, just one after the other, like you're writing to your mother. It was just like calligraphy. And I don't know if he ever made mistakes.
The theoretical calculations established that the pusher plate would in fact survive. At the test range, the model experiments became more sophisticated, using multiple explosive charges. Freeman Dyson liked to watch.
To actually see him out there hanging out with these guys, playing with high explosives, they could have 400 pounds of C4 without any particular adult supervision.
After the flights were over, I picked up these chips from the ground just to keep them as souvenirs. So these are, in fact, the genuine Orion chips. These are just parts of the canister in which the high explosive was contained that blew up. The canister was only needed to hold the high explosive. It didn't play any part in propelling the ship. And we were lucky that we never got hit by any of these. There is a kind of scientist which I think I belong to, which loves inventing things and then playing around with inventions. And they are very often crazy. I mean, the mad scientist is not just a figure of speech. There really are such people. And they love to play around with crazy schemes. And some of them may even be dangerous. And so, I mean, the public is not altogether wrong in being a little bit scared of such people. We were a bunch of crazies in a certain way, and it was an unusual time when crazy people were actually given a chance to do their stuff.
My father had spent his whole life just scribbling on blackboards, and then we moved to California. He was flying this glider off a cliff. I mean, I'd go up on Saturdays and watch, and he would get in this thing and be winched right over the edge of this cliff and fly around, and if he did okay, come back. And you know, my dad was doing that. I'd never dreamed of him doing anything like that. So it made the whole idea of going into space just seem that much closer. Cars looked like spaceships, and jet planes were flying overhead. They were building Atlas missiles by the hundreds. Orion fit right in.
Project Orion was of its time, a time when cars had tail fins but no seat belts, and rock and roll was playing on the radio.
Balls of fire!
In Las Vegas, the mafia were building the casinos, and 60 miles away in the Nevada desert, the government was letting off the bombs.
Nuclear weapons were very much part of sort of the general consciousness. It was a Cold War situation. The Russians were testing above ground. The British were testing above ground. The French were testing above ground. Everybody and his mother was testing above ground. People thought it was essential to have these weapons and to have a large variety of them, which made the whole thing possible, because Orion worked on having small, highly efficient, directed nuclear explosions. And if there had not been a Cold War to worry about, who would have spent the money on that?
It would take 1,000 bombs to lift Orion into space. More bombs would accelerate it to 50,000 miles an hour, and still more would be needed to slow it down again for landing on Mars, or wherever.
Maybe one of the largest challenges would get the bombs out of the ship in perfect sequence. So 2 to 4 times a second, either twice a second or 4 times per second, you have to eject a bomb from the ship. So that's a great challenge of mechanical engineering.
We had consulted with some people from the Coca-Cola company because we thought that the machinery you need for handling 2,000 bombs would be somewhat similar to the machines people use for handling Coca-Cola bottles.
And they had lots of ideas about how to grab these little bombs and move them down the racks and get them out the ship and bring the next one. You had to be able to select different flavors because if you, as you went up through the atmosphere, you needed to increase the yield, sort of the opposite of what you would think. And if you had a dud, then the next one had to be a half momentum charge. So you always had to be suddenly, everybody's wanting Coke, and then suddenly somebody wants an orange soda. You've got to be able to grab it and get it in line.
In the years since Hiroshima, weapon designers like Ted Taylor had developed atomic bombs that could fit into artillery shells. The design details of the Orion bombs are still secret, but Taylor was confident that making them small enough and powerful enough was not a problem.
And the final challenge, the easy one, is, okay, how do you actually build the ship? You know, the part where the people live and have their reading room and, you know, groceries and kitchen and all that. And that's sort of the easy part. That's just shipbuilding. The sister company of General Atomic was building the nuclear submarine fleet. So the assumption was that if the project really got the go-ahead, probably they would have brought in the submarine people to actually design and build the ship. That the technical problems of building a submarine to go, you know, 500 meters down in the ocean are as bad or worse than the technical problems of building a vehicle for the vacuum of space.
Certainly it looked much more like a submarine than like an airplane. It was sort of heavy construction with heavy steel, full of all kinds of heavy equipment, and most of it stainless steel, cogwheels and drive shafts, and a lot of just plain old-fashioned rotating machinery.
Looking forward to Orion's maiden flight was a test pilot who'd flown every high-performance aircraft in the U.S. Air Force.
Like an experimental airplane, it's something, it's there, you really want to fly it. And looking at Orion, it was the ultimate dream. It was basically riding a pogo stick, and that was certainly doable.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
I think it would be the most impressive, most startling, interesting, and in many ways beautiful spectacle caused by action by human beings.
We were going to launch from a barge at sea to get away from the neighbors, but it would have been a very, very loud and very impressive event. It would be going up from the surface of the ocean, bump, 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 like that, going up, bigger explosion each time.
It must be 50 years or so since I heard about Project Orion. I'm sure the idea startled me, this concept of using nuclear bombs, bang, 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 to drive yourself around the solar system. But I don't think I dismissed it. Every time I get into a motor car, I'm being driven around by a series of rapid explosions. Orion isn't a crazy idea even now. It's an ambitious one, but it certainly isn't crazy. The idea is not crazy. It's the idea that we might do it might be crazy. It'll soon be half a century since Stanley Kubrick wrote to me and said he wanted to make the proverbial good science fiction movie. Well, we're planning to film 2001. Stanley and I thought of using that technology. And it might have been quite spectacular, although I believe that when atomic bombs do go off in space, you don't see a great deal. I think Stanley wanted to avoid the Orion concept because he just made Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And he felt that having done that, he didn't want to do anything more in connection with atomic bombs. Freeman Dyson, who's one of the few authentic geniuses I've ever met, he wrote a wonderful book called Disturbing the Universe, and he would like to rearrange the solar system and make it nearer to our heart's desire, and that is something which I'm sure will happen in the next few centuries.
Something like Mars by 1965 and Saturn by 1970 was the sort of the slogan we went by. Establishing human colonies was certainly part of our plan, and not only humans, but of course crop plants and everything else that goes with it. So we wanted to find places which were hospitable to life, and of course for that Mars was the obvious choice. We didn't imagine that you'd go there the way people talk about it today, going there for a couple of weeks and then coming back. We thought of it certainly several years to have a chance really to explore the planet, maybe grow the first crops, and then maybe come home or maybe stay there.
When Freeman got involved, he very quickly did this study on trips to the satellites of the outer planets, where he showed that a little more fuel than going to Mars, you could actually take a longer trip, go all the way to Saturn, stop at one of the moons, refuel with more propellant. That's not nuclear fuel, it's just ice or something to pack around the bomb to get momentum to come home, and come back to Earth 4 years later.
Then the second trip would be to the satellites, which were already then well known to be interesting places. Jupiter has about six, and Saturn has about four big satellites. Each of them could be a habitable world. We know that they have lots of ice and other chemicals that are essential to life. A particular place I was interested in was Enceladus, which is one of the satellites of Saturn. And that was interesting because it has a rather low escape velocity, so it would be easy to land.
I mean, the human effort that went into these planning studies of trajectories to when was a good time to go to Venus and how you could go to Venus and Mars for just a little more fuel than Mars alone, but then you couldn't stay as long on Mars and you would get bored at Venus, there were no moons. And so all these questions became very real.
There's a certain feeling about space and what's in it that is just a big high. Everything that you can think of that people do is different in space, from sexual activity to just plain feeling as though you're resting on a cloud. The idea that you personally, not getting things ready for somebody else, but going there and doing it yourself, is unbearably exciting.
I always thought Ted was very dreamy. He was thinking of this Queen Mary-like thing which would float around the solar system. I always looked on it a little cynically. I mean, it was fine. I didn't have anything against it. But I wasn't persuaded that this was going to happen.
We used to talk about going to these far out, to the edge of the edge of our solar system, you know, with Orion. And I used to think that was kind of preposterous, I used to think.
There was few guys. They were not interested in flying no matter what it is. If you give them flying carpet, they wouldn't sit on it anyway.
Me? Oh, I wanted to go. But my feelings were sort of hurt. That, I mean, Ted was talking about taking his children, and my father said we were going to stay behind, so he was going to go without us.
I had just been switching between one wife and another, and it wasn't clear whether I had any family at all for a while.
While the Orioneers dreamed of colonizing Mars and Saturn, in the real world, they were being sidelined. The newly formed NASA space agency opted for beating the Russians to the moon using Wernher von Braun's chemical-powered rockets, not Orion. It was the first nail in the coffin of the project.
NASA, quite rightly, refused to have anything to do with it as long as it was secret. And that's, it was NASA policy not to have secrets, and I think that was right. As a civilian space agency, they do far better staying out in the open. So that was another of the fatal handicaps we had, that we were kept very tightly secret. So instead it went to the Air Force, much to our annoyance. But still, we had to live with the Air Force then from that point on. And the Air Force was quite understanding. They knew this wasn't a military weapon. They were prepared to pay for it because there were lots of people in the Air Force who shared our feelings. It was a great chance to go into space.
In the mountains of southern Colorado, George Dyson found two Air Force scientists and Orion supporters called Ed Giller and Don Priquet. Now neighbors in retirement, they were once colleagues at the Air Force Special Weapons Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Giller and Priquet were the key liaison officers for Project Orion.
I don't know where Orion got the name, but I'll have to put my two bits in here at the moment. Because it is an impulse system, we called it Putt-Putt at Kirkland, which the power to be thought we were being a little flippant with.
This, theoretically, was a factor of at least 1,000 better than anything we had coming down the pike on chemical missiles, rockets.
Giller and Priquet liked Orion, but there were skeptics in the Air Force top brass who needed to be persuaded to keep funding the research.
The liaison officer with the Air Force said, "You got to show them that it'll work. You know, why don't you make a model that flies?"
The Orioneers built a free-flying model, and they made a film for Ted Taylor to take to Washington to show to the disbelievers.
After the film, he said there was most marvelous silence. You could hear the pin drop, because they were all proven wrong. And there it was, and nobody can argue with it. It worked like a charm. First time we tried it, the thing took off like bat out of hell and flew.
There's a film that shows this thing going bang, 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 and up it goes a ways. At least that part of it worked.
One of the things was always the worry about the stability of the system, which that test proved. It managed to give people a little bit of an idea just what this thing would look like. It gave you a real good idea, what are these guys trying to do?
Paradoxically, this success contained the seeds of Orion's downfall. It inflamed the military imagination in ways that would destroy the project.
We were briefing some folks in the Pentagon once, senior military people, colonels from all the services, about how big this payload would be. And in fact, you could put people on it. You could put 150, 200 troops on it. And this is when a Marine colonel popped up and said, "That's just what I need to get my division across the Pacific in half an hour into some trouble spot."
A trap was looming for the Orioneers. To get the money, it seemed they would have to pretend to turn the plowshare back into a sword, and so betray the original peaceful aspirations of Orion.
Officially, it had to be justified to the budgeteers as a military program. So they had to invent fake military requirements for it.
had to name like sort of the six reports I would most like to get declassified. There was a report that on military applications of the Orion vehicle, where apparently they dreamed up all sorts of wild ideas. Sort of colorful one is the doomsday weapon, where you used Orion to launch an enormous, largest physical possible hydrogen bomb that would be left in orbit over the Soviet Union at a very high altitude. And then at the, you know, and then in Washington would be the big red button that, if all else failed, you pressed that button, and there, you know, there went the Soviet Union. Of course, there also went the climate of the Northern Hemisphere or whatever. But that was seriously looked at. Nobody thought it was a good idea, but the physics was done to determine what would happen if you did this.
As a military vehicle, of course, it was obviously the cat's meow. It could have evolved into something that was like the Death Star with it would have had the ability probably to decimate an entire planet. If not decimated, it would make living there hell.
The Death Star concept excited the generals at Strategic Air Command, always on the lookout for new ways to enforce peace.
As far as the Air Force is concerned, it's a weapon system in space. And that was almost a dirty word at those days, a weapon system in space, you know, especially a nuclear one.
Thomas Powers, who was second in command of Strategic Air Command, his response was, whoever controls Orion will control the world. And it had to be an American project. And he wanted, you know, to give it the billion-dollar full-speed go-ahead.
General Power ordered General Atomics to make a display model of Orion in full battle dress to show to President Kennedy. This turned out to be a mistake.
And there's one model that probably still exists, and someone watching this film may know where it is. Everyone talks about it. And it was the size of a car. And it was a model of this Orion battleship. And it had Kasaba howitzer, you know, nuclear cannons, and it had 25 megaton missiles that could, you know, destroy half the world, and it could turn around and protect itself by you know, it could hide behind its own pusher plate. The model was shown to President Kennedy and was apparently horrified that this was just the last thing the world needed was, you know, a giant nuclear weapons race in space.
It was another nail in the coffin. In the 5 years since Project Orion began, the world had changed. Concern about radioactive fallout from the bomb tests was turning to outrage. Strontium-90 was turning up in milk and babies' teeth. The public had seen the pictures from Hiroshima, and the Cuban Missile Crisis had brought the world to the brink of nuclear Armageddon. Suddenly, all things atomic were out of fashion. From the beginning of Project Orion, fallout had been among Freeman Dyson's concerns. He wanted to know how much radioactivity each Orion flight would add to the world total.
I wanted to know very precisely how many people would this fallout actually harm. And until I knew the answer to that question, I certainly wasn't prepared to fly in any of these ships and to approve the project in general. So I made that a high priority myself, to deal with this question of fallout. Well, I did the calculations, and they weren't very encouraging. Every time you took off and flew off into space, I calculated we would probably kill about somewhere between 1 and 10 people as a result of radioactive fallout. And that, to me, was unacceptable. So I said always right at the start, well, we've got to clean up the bombs and use much cleaner bombs if we got it down to something like a hundredth of a person, then I would consider that acceptable. I mean, it was a question of judgment. You could never do anything, of course, without risk to people, but at least you didn't want to be sure of killing somebody.
By 1963, Dyson's concerns about fallout had become conviction. As a consultant to the International Disarmament Agency, he had to choose between Project Orion and an end to all atmospheric bomb tests.
I knew that this test ban treaty that we were negotiating would be the final nail in the coffin of Orion. And still, of course, I said, yes, it should definitely go ahead. And I remember telling Ted Taylor that I was partly responsible for the test ban treaty. And it was so sad for Ted. And in a way, for me, it was just obvious by that time that the test ban treaty was right and that Orion had to give way.
We just got the orders to, shut her down. And that we did. And that ended Orion.
I'm totally opposed to any further development of any nuclear explosives, certainly, of any kind, for any purpose. With one exception, and that is Orion.
If we were able to do nuclear testing today, to test it, I'm pretty confident that we would get to do it.
If I had a lifespan of 200 or 300 years, I would give somebody odds that it will be built, that it will be flown. Now let's hope it doesn't suddenly appear in the sky like Sputnik and it belongs to an unfriendly rival.
The knowledge generated by the Orion scientists is still there, much of it top secret and highly dangerous.
A number of the things that were developed in Project Orion are still active military programs. And you can guess that if you talk to people and you'll see what they can talk about and what they can't. You very quickly come to areas that still cannot be talked about. And why can't they be talked about? Probably because they're active. We know they're active. There's a great deal of work still going on, particularly with small directed energy nuclear weapons, which have obvious military applications. It could be used to take out deep bunkers where there's only bad people. You say, well, there's only going to be bad people in these bunkers. Let's use one of these things. That's a very dangerous, tempting thing.
If Orion technology could break the taboo on battlefield nuclear weapons, its potential might also be exploited by terrorists. Orion bomb designs use small amounts of expensive plutonium and large amounts of relatively cheap high explosive.
And that is exactly the kind of bomb that terrorists would like to make, because they have easy access to lots of high explosive, very, very difficult access to fissionable material. So exactly the goal of the Orion physicists, unfortunately, is also the goal of someone, trying to illicitly make a nuclear weapon. So that's why that's a secret.
So the Orion paradox lives on. On the one hand, nuclear destruction. On the other, nuclear salvation. Some believe that Orion might be the only way to save the world. It may be the best technology to intercept and deflect an Earth-bound asteroid.
Some near-Earth object is coming, and we know it's coming, and we have 9 months or whatever, and we need to divert it. And Orion is one of the few existing ways we could do that. We're at risk of the whole planet could be wiped out, and it's a mistake to not look at that seriously.
Orion provides such an advantage in speed over chemical propellants that it seems that that interception could take place in a much shorter time scale, and consequently the deflection could take place on a further away, so there, it was easier to make such an object miss the Earth. Now, I want to point out that when I say technical things, they're correct. Generally, people recoil from the notion of using nuclear explosives. I do. I recoil from that notion because I know we don't have that kind of world. And I know that having nuclear explosives in space is inviting someone to misuse them.
Even now, the only way we could get large payloads around the solar system is by something like Orion, because atomic bombs contain thousands of times more energy, indeed almost millions of times more energy, than any of the chemicals that we use in our existing rockets, you know, like hydrogen and oxygen. They're feeble compared with the energies of an atomic bomb. So when you talk of sending hundreds of tons or even thousands of tons of payload, including human beings, from to Mars, say, that's the only way we could do it, even now. The space age hasn't begun yet. I believe the time will come when very few members of the human race will be able to point to the part of the sky where the Earth is.
I'm still very strongly interested in spreading life outside the Earth. Humans, of course, should go along, but the most important thing to me is just enlarging the domain of life. And life has this marvelous adaptability. It's able to adapt itself to almost anything. And so it's hardly begun yet, adapting itself to the universe. This little planet doesn't give it so much scope.
After Orion, Freeman Dyson went back to Princeton, physics and mathematics. But his dreams of space travel found a distant echo in his son's adventures in the Canadian Northwest.
Certainly, the building these kayaks and doing these voyages, that was my way of doing what my father had tried to do but had failed at. It wasn't his failure, it was a failure, I think, on the part of the imagination of the government. Orion did not get the support and go ahead. Well, I went out on my own and built these kayaks and did go to these far-off islands that were really like the planets of Jupiter. You could settle on them and refuel. And my boats had these semicircular sails, just like pusher plates. And you sort of coast, which is really what Orion was doing, was sort of surfing on these waves of plasma.
In 1965, Freeman Dyson published an impassioned article in the journal Science entitled Death of a Project. The story of Orion, he wrote, is significant because this is the first time in modern history that a major expansion of human technology has been suppressed for political reasons. But those who've worked on Project Orion must continue to hope that they may see their work bear fruit in their own lifetimes. They cannot lose sight of the dream which fired their imaginations in 1958 and sustained them through the years of struggle afterward. The dream that the bombs which killed and maimed at Nagasaki and Hiroshima may one day open the skies to mankind.